Shoranan Dana Braja Janharan Janha Yashoranan Dana Braja Janharan Janha Yamuna Tira Vanachari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Giri Varadari Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Giri Varadari Yashoranandana Raja Janharan Yashoranandana Raja Janharan Yashoranandana Raja Janharan Yashoranandana Raja Janharan Yamuna Tira
Sri the Prabhupada Ki. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Dayus tatsatop shivta vimana sankula. Diyus tat satot shipta vimana shankula. Protsarpatashma cha pada bipidita. Protsarpatashma cha pada bipidita. Shailaha smut. Patera Mushya Ramhasha Shailaha Smut Pater Amushya Ramhasha Tate Jasa Kam Kakubo Narijire Dayus Tat Satot Shipta Vimana Shankula. Protsarpatashma cha pada vipidita. Shailaha samut pater amushya ramhasha. Tate jasakam kakubo narijire. Dayus tat satot shipta vimana shankula. Protsarpatashma cha pada bipidita. Shailaha sumut pater amushya ramhasha. Tat te jasakam kakubo narijire. Sat satot shita vimana shankula. Protsar patashma cha pada bibidita. Shaira samukhtir musharam hasha. Tate chisa kam kakubon harijide. Yus tat satot shipta vimana shankula. Protsar patashma cha pada bipidita. Shailaha samut pater hamushya ramhasha. Tate jasa kam kakubo narijire. Dayus tat satot shipta vimana shankula. Protsar patashma cha pada bipidita. Shailaha samut patera mushya ramhasha. Tate jasa kam kakubo narijire. tatsato chitta vimana shankula. Protsarpatashma cha pada bipidita. Shailaha samut paterham mushiram hasha. Tate jasakam kakubo narijire. Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishtaya Bhutare Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Svaminiti Naminine. Namaste Sarasvati Devi Gauravani Pracharine Nivishesha Sunyavadi Paskatya Desatarine. Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Garadha Shri Vasari Gora Bhaktavrinda. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. So this is text 33 of the 8th chapter of the 7th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. Chapter entitled, Lord Nrsimhadev Slays the King of the Demons. Should we do the word for word? Dayuha, outer space. Tatsata, by his hair. Utshipta, thrown up. Vimana Shankula, filled with airplanes. Protsarpata, slipped out of place. Shma, the planet Earth. Cha, also. Pada abhipidita, distressed due to the heavy weight of the lotus feet of the Lord. Shailaha, the hills and mountains. Samut petaha, sprang up. Amusya, of that one, the Lord. Ramhasha, due to the intolerable force. Tat te jasa, by his effulgence. Kam, the sky. Kakubaha, the 10 directions. Narijide, did not shine. Translation in purport. Airplanes were thrown into outer space and the upper planetary system by the hair on the Srimadev's head. Because of the pressure of the Lord's lotus feet, the earth appeared to slip from its position. All the hills and mountains sprang up due to his intolerable force. Because of the Lord's bodily effulgence, both the sky and all directions diminished in their natural illumination. Purport. That there were airplanes flying in the sky long, long ago can be understood from this verse. Srimad Bhagavatam was spoken 5,000 years ago. And the statements of this verse prove that the symptoms of a very advanced civilization then existed, even in the upper planetary systems, as well as in the lower planetary systems. Modern scientists and philosophers foolishly explain that there was no civilization prior to 3,000 years ago. The statement of this verse nullifies such whimsical judgments. The Vedic civilization existed millions and millions of years ago. It existed since the creation of this universe, and it included arrangements all over the universe with all the modern amenities and even more. So, if you're anywhere near as skeptical as I am and you read this verse, say, airplanes in the sky 5,000 years ago, millions of years ago, you'd be a little skeptical, no? Like, you know, didn't the Wright brothers invent the airplane? If there are ancient airplanes, where are all the ancient airports, you know? We're uncovering things all the time. You know, speculations and questions like these will come up. Not going to get you anywhere. I remember when I was in high school, I had this real profound idea. I said, I'm going to read the Bible from cover to cover. So I started in the book of Genesis. Right? Simple enough. But then, like, you get into the middle of Genesis, and it's just these lists of people's names. It's like Moses had 17 children. They list all 17 names of his children, and they're like, and then Moses lived on to be 700 years old. And then they go each one of his 17 sons. You know, they'll say how many sons he had, and then that he lived to be 1,000 years old. So I was like, this doesn't seem like in line with my perception of like the human lifespan. So I went to my mom. I said, what's up with this? Like, they're saying people live to be 1,000 years old. Is this, did they determine time differently back then or something? She said, no, people lived to be older back then. I was like, well, how is that possible? She gave some explanation. I think it was a pretty good explanation. So, you know, I went back to my room, you know, with the Bible, the book of Genesis. Meditated on it for a few days and determined, no, there's no way. You know, because basically I'm not only skeptical of the knowledge that the Bible gave me at the time, and even potentially what the Srimad Bhagavatam gives us now, but even dismissive of it because of some prior knowledge we claim to possess, you know. No, I know that, you know, the longest lifespans of humanity are happening right now due to modern science, etc. We get this knowledge, it's been imparted to us in the most formative years of our lives, not in a gurukul, as the Vedic scriptures recommend, but in the American public education system. And so we get this from our teachers, and they get it from a textbook, essentially. This textbook, you know, the new Shastra, this Shabda designed to enlighten the youth of the nation, you know. Seems safe enough, but here's the problem. The textbook is compiled by a college professor, right? You pay $300 for the book, written by the professor, and then you pay $3,000 to attend his class. And your friend at another university paid $300 for a different book written by their professor who's teaching their class that they're paying $5,000 to attend. So is the content of these books the same? Maybe, maybe not. I'm sure it differs at some point. But regardless, somehow, we believe, you know, that the knowledge we've got from our professor, from our textbook, is infallible, you know? Like, we have the perfect knowledge, but this is a defect. Prabhupada says, knowledge taken from a conditioned being is sure to be defective. He doesn't say it might be defective. He says it's sure to be defective. He says this in the SSR for those of you who may be following along with the references here. But it says no matter how qualified your professor may be, how much research he's done firsthand, how many books he's written, how long he's been in the field, he's still a conditioned soul. He still has four defects. First defect, perceptual ineptitude. The senses are limited. Imperfect, the eye can only see so far. The ear can only hear within a certain range of frequencies. And then you say, oh, well, a dog, you know, can hear outside. You know, so a dog has perfect senses. No, the dog also has limited hearing. And even though you could train a specific breed of dog to maybe sniff out a certain breed of bug, it's still going to be imperfect, you know. He can only smell the bug within 5 feet, you know. He can only smell the bug 98.6% of the time. But yet history and science, they're taught through empiricism, or the scientific method. You know, what does this mean? It means that the science is based on things that can only be readily experienced or perceived by the senses. Pratyaksha. But as we learned, first of all, the senses are imperfect. Second of all, we misperceive even with these limited senses. For example, this weekend, Michael and I, we were helping Carlos move stuff out of his apartment. So he's on the third floor, moving everything down the stairs. Michael's moving things down the stairs. I'm loading up stuff into the car. But then I got everything loaded, so I went back up to take some more stuff out of the apartment, bring it down. Well, Michael, he's on the flight directly above me, so I know he can't see me. But I can hear him because he's, like, making a big ruckus. You know, he's got a big box in his hand. He's stomping on the floor. So I thought I would have a little fun with him. So I came up with the most ridiculous voice I could. I said, "Rascals!" And he immediately gets pissed. He starts looking around up at the apartments. He's like, who in this apartment building is calling me a rascal, you know? So I just started laughing, and he realized that I was on the flight directly below him and that I had said rascals. So this is an example of misperception. Could be something as simple as seeing a rope, thinking it's a snake. Seeing someone crying, thinking they're real sad, really they're just in tears of ecstasy. But the problem in science and history comes is that, say historians, you know, they're studying these firsthand accounts, people who were actually there at the time this historical event they're studying took place. Let's just say hypothetically, for instance, that the source they're studying is completely flawless. Right, it's just a perfect representation of what happened. Even us, you know, centuries later, with the flaw of misperception, we're not going to get the perfect interpretation out of it. But because we can't have, we have a limited ability to tell if something is true or false, or real or unreal. Similarly, this text the historian is studying is imperfect because it's also written by a conditioned soul. So, how many imperfections, you know, is it going to take to get to the truth that is, you know, modern history? And the third defect is delusion. We choose not to investigate our misperceptions. We prefer to believe in them. We prefer to believe in them because they're ours. We like them. We invented them, right? We came up with them. We're very attached to them. So, ironically enough, historians are actually aware of this defect. They don't mention many of the other ones, but they have this phenomenon in history called the confirmation bias, which is where you're doing a study, right? But you selectively gather information, essentially. You only pay attention to the information that supports your pre-existing beliefs, or the hypothesis you've hypothesized, and you ignore all the other information, or maybe you don't ignore it, you read it, but it just doesn't, you don't interpret it in the right way. So someone who read the same source, you know, and reads the study you did on the source, they're like, "Hey, but what about, you know, this person said this in the text?" You go, "Oh, no. Trust me, I studied it very thoroughly. I'm certain I have the very accurate study here." Now, that's the fourth defect. That's when we hide the flaw in our own perception. It's dishonest. An archaeologist digs up something and goes, "Oh, look at this. I've never seen this before." And you go, "Oh, yes." You know, study it for a second. Concoct something in your head. "Oh, yes, this is what the peasants used as an eating utensil, you know. And this is cheating propensity. It's very dishonest." So, considering all these defects of the conditioned soul, it's no surprise to see that the history textbooks are changing every 3 years. So we have a new history book every 3 years. But history doesn't change, right? That's the nature of the past. You can't change it. But yet, these new textbooks implies that history does change, no? It implies that history is outdated. That we have to accommodate new historical perspectives and new historical theories. And you think about it, this doesn't make a whole lot of sense. My favorite class in high school, or at least my sophomore year of high school, was AP World History. Did anyone else take AP World? European History? Sounds more advanced. They didn't offer that at my high school. They had AP U.S. History, but I hated that class. It was basically as good as math class. You memorize a bunch of things, and you know that's what you're graded on, how well you remembered everything. But AP World History, oh man, that was my thing, you know, because you didn't have to study. Basically, you were encouraged to speculate. The more you could speculate, the more far out your speculations were, the better you would do on, like, the free response essays. Because essentially, you come up with a hypothesis based on history. They'll give you, like, a specific historical event or time period. And you just say something. And you can say, you can make any claim on the truth you want to, so long as you have some evidence to back it up, some historical evidence. So you can imagine high school students have a field day with this stuff. And historians will always be in conflict because there's always conflicting evidence. So, for example, I would write an essay based on the evidence that I paid attention to support my beliefs, and someone else on the other side of the classroom would compose a very different essay, you know, based on their beliefs and the evidence that they gathered to support their beliefs. Any good historian will tell you that history is popular opinion. Basically, person with the most evidence wins, with the most influence, is going to be the most successful historian. But nonetheless, new evidence arises all the time. Old conceptions of history are overturned. There's even a whole field of study called historiography, which is where you don't study history, you don't study historical events. You study how the historical events have changed in historians' interpretations over time. So this is a field of study. This is real. People make a living off of studying how history has changed. Like, this should not be the case. Essentially, this is a real long-winded way of posing the question, which Shabda are we going to believe? The Shabda that changes every 3 years and is in constant flux, and we have limited evidence to support? Or are we going to listen to the infallible, eternal literature, which has not been changed for centuries, eternally? Are we going to believe the conditioned soul, you know, who's plagued by the four defects? Are we going to listen to Prabhupada, who's really encouraging us here to just accept the descending method? Any questions on this verse before we go on to the next one? All right. Oh. Or corrections, revisions?
Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna Prabhu. Thank you. Very nice class. Maybe you remember when we were discussing with Bhakti Swarup Chaitanya Maharaj, he mentioned that he heard in a class of Guru Govinda Maharaj that faith comes from simplicity. So I always wonder, I mean, when somebody is simple, doesn't have a lot of previous knowledge, as you was mentioning, that kind of is an obstacle to get that true knowledge. At the same time, when you are simple, you can get the right knowledge, and also you can be very, very easy misguided to a wrong knowledge too. So could you please expand a little bit on this? Like being simple and get the right knowledge from the right source and not be misled. Where's the guarantee?
uh, So, in the SSR, Prabhupada talks a lot about, you know, there's a lot of interviews in there. And reporters ask questions a lot about, you know, but, you know, aren't spiritual masters frauds? You know, aren't, how do we know that, you know, you're the real deal? Prabhupada says, if the spiritual master, or if anything, is giving you information, or knowledge that's getting you closer to Krishna, then I think you can trust it. That may be a little too simple, but
it's funny that this thing about the airplanes came up today in Bhagavatam class, because yesterday I was just thinking about this, because we were on our way back from Harinam and I saw a license plate from Ohio, and on the license plate it was like really proudly declared, Ohio, the birthplace of aviation. It's like, before Ohio, there were no airplanes, and thanks to Ohio, there's airplanes now. We invented them.
Thank you, Ohio. All right, next verse. Text 34. We'll go right to the translation here. Manifesting a full effulgence and a fearsome countenance, Lord Nrsimha, being very angry and finding no contestant to face his power and opulence, then sat down in the assembly hall on the excellent throne of the king. Because of fear and obedience, no one could come forward to serve the Lord directly. Purport. When the Lord sat on the throne of Hiranyakashipu, there was no one to protest. No enemy came forward on behalf of Hiranyakashipu to fight with the Lord. This means his supremacy was immediately accepted by the demons. Another point is that although Hiranyakashipu treated the Lord as his bitterest enemy, he was the Lord's faithful servant in Vaikuntha, and therefore the Lord had no hesitation in sitting on the throne that Hiranyakashipu had so laboriously created. Srila Vishvanath Chakravarti Thakur remarks in this connection that sometimes, with great care and attention, great saintly persons and rishis offer the Lord valuable seats dedicated with Vedic mantras and tantras. But still the Lord does not sit upon those thrones. Hiranyakashipu, however, had formerly been Jaya, the doorkeeper at the Vaikuntha gate. And although he had fallen because of the curse of the Brahmanas and had gotten the nature of a demon, and although he had never offered anything to the Lord as Hiranyakashipu, the Lord is so affectionate to his devotee and servant that he nonetheless took pleasure in sitting on the throne that Hiranyakashipu had created. In this regard, it is to be understood that the devotee is fortunate in any condition of his life. So this is pretty interesting. That the biggest demon, basically in history, Hiranyakashipu, the Lord will still sit on a throne constructed by him. Because of the devotional service, basically, Hiranyakashipu had performed in the past. He was formerly Jaya. Do y'all know the story? So he was the... There are several gates in Vaikuntha, right? And they have gatekeepers. Well, at the innermost gate, there was Jaya and Vijaya, who went on to become Hiranyakashipu, Hiranyakashipu's brother. But it's because the four Kumaras came. It's like little five-year-old boys. And to the gates, and Jaya's like, no, you're not getting in here. This is the gate of Narayan, you know. He's not accepting company at this time. Besides, you have no right to see him, you know, your little kid. They said, you know, you should really watch who you're talking to. Essentially, they were very elevated brahmanas. And so they cursed him to take birth in the material world. But I believe Vishnu gave him the option. Four lives as a devotee, three lives as a demon. But his devotion to Narayan was so strong that he's three lifetimes as a demon was his preferred choice so that he could get back to Vaikuntha as soon as possible. Such is the nature of true devotion. But as you can see, that's
It's a pretty crazy, like, it's not just any simple demon he became. He became Hiranyakashipu, but... you think about it, we're all, everyone here, oh, at least myself, I can't speak for everyone else. I'm pretty demoniac. We're pretty demoniac, right? We've eaten meat. We've done a lot of crazy things, you know? We've done a lot of real bad things in this lifetime, since time immemorial, right? So we have a demon in our own heart. But, you know, maybe if we perform some sincere devotional service, Lord Nrsimhadev will descend into our heart, tear out the intestines of the demon that lives there, hang it around his neck, and sit on the throne he's constructed. We can only pray for this. Prabhupada says, a devotee is fortunate in any condition of his life. So this does not mean we have to serve at the gates of Vaikuntha, you know, to get the Lord's favor. Right? We can do some simple devotional service here, so long as it's sincere. There's a chapter in the SSR, a lady writes a letter to Prabhupada. She's like, oh, these devotees in California, you know, they're so, like, mean and negative. And, like, why is this? Aren't you, like, trying to teach peace and love and stuff? Prabhupada says, you know, they may be imperfect right now, but they have the perfect knowledge, and as such, are more fortunate than anyone who has not received this knowledge, anyone who's never performed devotional service, even in such, like, a neophyte stage. They're already more fortunate than, you know, the majority of creation. Any questions? I can go on to the next text here. All right. Text 35. Hiranyakashipu had been exactly like a fever of meningitis in the head of the three worlds. Thus, when the wives of the demigods and the heavenly planets saw that the great demon had been killed by the personal hands of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, their faces blossomed in great joy. The wives of the demigods again and again showered flowers from heaven upon Lord Nrsimhadev like rain. At that time, it's text 36, at that time the airplanes of the demigods, who desired to see the activities of the Supreme Lord Narayan, crowded the sky. The demigods began beating drums and kettle drums, and upon hearing them, the angelic women began to dance, while the chiefs of the Gandharvas sang sweetly. This is such a beautiful description, you know. Hiranyakashipu, it all started, you know, I guess, well, it started a long time ago, but essentially, you know, he hits the pillar, and boom, there's this thunderous sound heard all over the three worlds, and demigods are like, I don't know how they know, but they're like, get in your airplanes, everyone. bring the flowers, there's going to be some showering involved, you know. And, you know, and but Lord knows he's so intense, you know, in the previous verses he's just flipping his mane and the airplanes are being flung into outer space and they're hiding behind clouds because they're so scared of Hiranyakashipu. But seeing this, I mean, this is such a powerful, you know, incarnation of Narayan. Yeah, I would pull up an airplane too, you know. Text 37-39. My dear King Yudhishthira, the demigods then approached the Lord. They were headed by Lord Brahma, King Indra, and Lord Shiva, and included great saintly persons and the residents of Pritarloka, Shitaloka, Vidyadharloka, and the planet of the snakes. The Manus approached, and so did the chiefs of various other planets. The angelic dancers approached, as did the Gandharvas, the Charanas, the Yakshas, the inhabitants of Kinaraloka, the Vetalas, the inhabitants of Kimpurushloka, and the personal servants of Vishnu, like Sunanda and Kumuda. All of them came near the Lord, who glowed with intense light. They individually offered their obeisances and prayers, their hands folded at their heads. This is really beautiful, you know. Really beautiful description. Does anyone have anything to add? Shri the Prabhupada Ki.